Hello and welcome to Beating the Drum for Biodiversity. My name is Celia Carana and this is your podcast for understanding the importance of biodiversity for our health, our food and the survival of the planet.
Hello everyone. On today's episode, we're going to be listening into a conversation that I had earlier this week with the wonderful Guy Michael Williams, all about his story as an ecologist, a conservationist, and the importance of human connection to nature. Guy's work in conservation has been focused on better understanding the behaviours, needs and vulnerabilities of primates to better support their protection. Guy has travelled the world to communicate the measurable and immeasurable value of primates to local communities, businesses and local governments to try and resolve those conflicts between human and non-human primates. His stories are just incredible. Guy is passionate about us connecting with nature, understanding that nature is everywhere despite our online lives in a built-up environment. He believes the health, the protection and conservation of nature around us is fundamental to our own health, happiness and survival. I learned so much from this conversation and I hope you enjoy listening to it too. Hello Guy, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks a lot, Celia.
I know there's something that you want to play for us, so do you want to play that noise?
Yeah, it was just a little recording of a friend of mine, but I'll just play this to kick it off.
What was that, Guy?
That was a Western Hulup gibbon, and yeah, that was from a zoo in Indonesia. But the right reason I wanted to play it is because there was a gibbon that I had quite a close connection with early on in my career that had quite an influential role in shaping my view of nature and our connection with nature. Her name was Mary, and she was a solitary gibbon that was kept at Taronga Zoo in Sydney for about 20 years. And she lived a sad life in terms of she came from the wild and she was brought to a zoo, and she made a call like that every single morning when I would arrive at the zoo to start work. And at first I found it haunting and beautiful. I think it lingered to be quite a sad call, and her story and her plight was probably quite a sad one, but it really made me kind of consider our relationship with nature, both in the city, in the urban environment, and also those of us who can spend time out in the forest where Mary comes from.
Yeah, that's amazing. Like, just hearing that sound for the first time, I thought it was a bird. Like, I had no idea that it was a gibbon. So you've already taught us something.
Yeah, it travels, you know, really across the landscape, and you can hear it in the distance, particularly early in the morning, like dawn and dusk. And it's a really powerful call. It really kind of dominates the forest. And most people who actually hear it think it is a bird. But yeah, it's one of our closest, nearest and dearest cousins in the gibbon.
So you mentioned there about kind of Taronga Zoo and also time in the forest. I was wondering what your first memory or first connection to nature is, and then we can get into a bit more of your journey.
Yeah, sure. Gosh, it's going back a long time now to think about first connections. I suppose I was always relatively lucky and blessed in coming from a family where we spent a lot of time in nature from my earliest memories. We were a family of campers. We were a family of bushwalkers. And we always did it in quite a simple way. It was typically carrying everything on our backs, or in my earliest years, I was actually on my father's back. So really some of my earliest memories as a family, that family unit and the bonds that I have with my siblings and my parents kind of come from walking through the forest. And then probably what really kind of connected me to a life trying to conserve and protect nature was through when I first learned about primates like Mary. The similarities that they had to us and my early experience of the family unit kind of navigating through a forest and finding a forest as a place of beauty and of intrigue and of food, and it's a place where you live and you sleep, nothing foreign or fearful about it. And that's really just kind of shaped my career, both the connection with primates and the need to kind of be a bit of a spokesperson for those who don't have a voice in the animals and primates, but also in terms of that relationship that we have with nature, making sure that it's properly valued and that we have opportunities to have that connection with nature.
Yeah, I think so many of us as children have that innate connection to nature, but then as adults and we get into the working world, and many of us end up as kind of cogs in the wheel and kind of lose that connection. But that's not the path that you took. So I know your first job was at Taronga Zoo. So how did that kind of, I suppose, come about, and what came from it?
It was Well, I grew up in Sydney. I'm here in Sydney, Australia, and I think we are quite blessed in having multiple opportunities to connect with nature here, whether it's the, you know, the big blue of the ocean and the harbour, or whether it's the green of the forest and the mountains. But I always kind of dreamt and longed for forests further away that I couldn't get to until I left the family nest when I left school. And so for me, the only logical pathway to have connections with those primate forests overseas was as to work at the zoo. That was kind of the dream job. I was influenced by kind of stories of people who worked at zoos and who had relationships with zoos, and it always seemed like the first pathway for me to go. Sydney Taronga Zoo was obviously the place to be. It was a really hard place to get a job. I remember from my earliest stage of, like, you know, work experience when I was 13, applying and writing letters and getting them like reviewed by teachers, you know, does it really convey how much I want to work at the zoo? And I had multiple rejections. And I had this strategy that the best way to get a job somewhere where you really want to work is to choose and to actively express passion for the worst job at the place where you want to work. And so I kind of thought about this, and I had a bit of a strategy, kind of made up, I don't know where this kind of came from, that the worst job at the zoo was in preparing the food that all of the animals eat. Because if you think about it, you know, kind of not everyone does, but what do zoo animals eat? A lot of them eat fruit and they eat things like that, but a lot of them are also kind of omnivores and carnivores, and they eat all sorts of other kind of critters. And so at Taronga Zoo, there's a back of house building that's called the live feed unit, where it's an old house and each of the bedrooms has been converted into a different line of food production. And I don't want to obviously gross out the listeners, but if you think about it, the reptiles like to eat particularly mice, small rats. Cockroaches are also very popular with a lot of insectivorous animals, mealworms, grasshoppers. And my favourite, this is actually where I had my interview for my first job at the zoo, was in the maggot room.
Oh, my God.
Where they had large plastic tubs full of small fly larvae, which they fed to a range of birds and reptiles. So, yeah, I got a job in the live breeding unit, and it was a tough place to work because of the smell, and wasn't the most romantic job. But, yeah, one thing led to another, and I was only there for a couple of months and I moved on to other jobs at the zoo.
That's amazing. I mean, yeah, as a resident vegan, I am very much not don't enjoy hearing about all the live animals that get eaten, but appreciate the circle of life and all that stuff, though. It's yeah, you must have really wanted to work there to have got involved in the maggot room. But I suppose that does kind of show that just because animals aren't the kind of cute and fluffy ones, they still need our kind of protection. But
yeah, sure.
You did go after some, I don't know if I'd call them cute and fluffy, but definitely significantly more interesting than maggots when you kind of went off into the jungle and did those expeditions. So do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, since that, as I mentioned, as soon as I left working at the zoo, and it was probably that interaction with Mary, the gibbon, on a daily basis that meant it wasn't the place for me, and I ultimately wasn't going to be able to have the effect and to have the connection that I wanted to have. And so, yeah, I then started to do research, and that was my time at university. And I've been studying a particular group of leaf-eating monkeys that occur in the kind of the Southeast Asia. So they occur on the border of Myanmar, China and Vietnam. Snub-nosed monkeys, they're called. They occur typically in really high, steep, kind of quite remote parts of that part of the world. They're absolutely beautiful, hard to follow and hard to track. But I've the first time I had that opportunity to go across, it was to China to study those monkeys, and I've been kind of going back ever since. So those first experiences back then, now kind of 15, nearly 20 years ago, have kind of stayed with me, and I've continued to be able to go back and have that connection with that part of the world.
That's amazing. I think so many of us like dream of being able to do something similar, of getting lost in the forest and seeing these incredible creatures. Do you remember the first time you saw one of those monkeys?
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw the golden snub-nosed monkey, which is in Sichuan, which was I don't have the ability to throw up photos, but if you have a chance to Google and see these, they're absolutely striking, really stunning. And I chose the hardest job, which was studying the young males that left the family unit to kind of see where they went after they got to a certain age and they're kind of kicked out by dad, typically dad, who says to the young blokes, like, you're causing a bit of trouble. We can't really support you anymore. It's time for you to move on. And so they get kicked out and they hang out on the edge of the home range. They form sometimes bachelor units, so a group of young misfits up to no good. Sometimes they're solitary and they're really fast because they're really fit and they're really elusive and hard to follow. So the first time I saw a golden snub-nosed monkey, young male, I'd actually been tracking that same family unit for about 4 months. So I'd been every day waking up, heading out at the crack of dawn, walking up these steep limestone mountains and hearing, like Mary, hearing them in the distance but having no chance to see them. And it was one really early morning when the snow had fallen and they'd kind of slowed down to eat some of the mosses and the fungi that they eat off the bark of this particular tree, where I was able to see them. And, it was pretty amazing. Once again, one of those moments that really made it all worth it.
Yeah, for sure. And did you have any interactions with the monkeys? Like, did they realize that you were there?
No, not at all. I think it was something to do with the sharp change in weather, and it just went really cold, and so they really slowed down. I've never seen them before or after kind of behaving that way. Kind of really seemed they just kind of just had to kind of conserve energy, and so their movement was all focused around just staying warm. And all of their defences, which were typically the reason why I hadn't been able to see them, kind of went out the window, so that I was able to get really close. And it was the first time since that I've actually been able to get that close to primates. For me, a lot of people, when I tell them about, you know, what my passion is and what my work is, they say, you know, do you have that connection with them? Have you had them as a pet? You know, do you hold them? You know, have you been able to kind of play with young monkeys? And I never have, and I never really wanted to. And I've kind of realized probably latterly that, you know, if I'm doing my job well, which is typically focused around conserving the habitat for these monkeys, if I'm doing my job well, then I'm not seeing them. If I am seeing them, then they're probably too used to humans. I can get too close to them, and others who probably want to do them some harm can also get close to them. So for me, the judge of if I'm doing my job well is if I can hear them, like Mary, in the distance in the morning. I can head out looking for them. I know they're there, but I can't see them or get too close to them. That's probably one of the best measures I have of kind of effective primate conservation.
Yeah, that's so true. I think so many of us get so swept up in the, like, oh, look, they're cute.
Yeah.
Like holding the koalas at the zoo, etc. But actually, it's so much better to observe them in their natural habitat and see how they behave in that way.
Yeah.
And so that was your first expedition. Since then, have there been other ones that you've been working on?
Yeah. I mean, I've been really fortunate since I started my kind of working career to be able to do a combination of kind of primate research, of conservation projects and projects that are helping us to understand once again what happens to these young sub-adult male primates and where they go. But I've also been able to work as a consultant, working with business, actually, working with organisations quite different to pure conservation, working with the often seen as the big bad end of town, is in terms of actually helping them to be able to kind of value nature. So probably some of the most amazing expeditions I've been able to do and trips I've been able to go on to some of the most remote parts of the forests of the world has been on these projects where there is other, you know, human activities that are happening at a really, you know, fast pace at a real vast scale, and where there's a potential, if they're not kind of kept in check, that they can have a real impact on more than just the primates, actually on a whole range of different species and ecosystems. So yeah, that's taken me to quite a few different places, and that balance between kind of biodiversity and business, and has kind of become a second kind of vocation. I felt that's something that's equally as important as getting lost in forest, is also being able to connect the businesses that have the biggest impact on conservation and on forest loss, being able to somehow connect them with what's actually happening in their projects, in their supply chains where they source their materials from, and also connect, hopefully, you know, the consumers that are buying the products from these places. So that that's also a key part of what's allowing me at the moment to, maybe not right now with COVID, but before COVID, to still be able to go on these great adventures and be really lucky to be able to, you know, have some great trips. But it's typically with that kind of eye on keeping a business watchdog.
Yeah. And I know that's kind of leading us into what you do now, but before we get into that, have there been any situations where you've been involved in stopping a certain activity that has had a positive impact that you're really proud of?
Yes, probably not stopping a particular. I have been involved in quite a few projects where I've been able to go in and see the potential impact of a large development, a large kind of hydropower energy project or a large proposed mine. And based on the input of me, but also a larger a team of people who are considering the social and cultural values, the, you know, the water aquatic values, as well as the animals that I'm focused on, and kind of that kind of collective effort has been able to present a picture that this is not a smart place to develop, that this has values which are both immeasurable and also measurable. So they're going to be, you know, best preserved than actually eroded or destroyed. But I suppose probably one of the biggest projects that I've been involved in has been some work with in the forest industry, in the timber industry, and that's around kind of shifting the way that they do that type of that logging. And then once again, that's been associated with supply chains and trying to kind of connect the company and the consumer with where their materials are coming from. And the project I'm talking about was with a large Australian timber retailer, and it was kind of connected with the great Australian dream to buy a house, just still the dream for most people to buy a house. Doesn't matter if it's an old house, probably the better if it needs a little bit of, you know, home renovation, backyard blitz. And one of the first things that most people do when they do buy a place to do up is consider the deck, the great Aussie dream to have a deck where you can have your Barbie and you can sit out there. But what most people don't consider is where the decking timber comes from. And nearly, well, over 75% of decking timbers in Australia comes from Indonesia, from West Papua, a really old, ancient forest system that kind of connects Australia and this land with Asia up through Papua New Guinea and into West Papua. And it's all sourced from there. And so one of the trips I did was able to kind of go with a senior manager from the company, and to be able to connect him to the forest, for him to be able to tell stories and come back to both his kids and his colleagues and the customers, and to kind of say that actually this place is special and we can't just cut it all down. So they're still continuing to source from that forest, but they're just doing it in a really different way.
That's amazing. Yeah. So, yeah, so you've had these amazing experiences of spending time in nature and working with businesses. How has that kind of shaped what you're doing now and what are you getting up to these days?
Yeah, so it's as I said, I feel extremely fortunate to, from an age, you know, before I can remember, I've always wanted to do what I'm kind of doing. And so I don't expect it to kind of stop. So it has really kind of continued along in the same way. I'm still being able to spend as much time kind of supporting the primate community, as well as the work I'm doing at the moment with business. We're in a really fortunate time, I believe, which has been brought about through a really unfortunate set of circumstances, where nature and biodiversity is being kind of valued and I think considered differently. And probably larger than it has before by all of us. And I think the movement around climate change and the fact that climate really is inextricably linked to healthy ecosystems and to biodiversity, and also the fact that we've had some terrible kind of natural disasters, particularly here in Australia with bushfires, but also globally with COVID and the pandemic, which has made us kind of reevaluate our kind of place in nature and how we kind of see it. So I'm just noticing at the moment, particularly over the last 6 months, and maybe I think COVID and the various states of lockdown that we're all in has had an impact, that there is a real shift in how everyone, but business in particular, is looking at biodiversity and that broader relationship with nature. So that's making me just really busy.
Yeah, I can imagine. But hopefully a bit hopeful as well that there's that much interest from business. Have you noticed a pickup in that as well over the last kind of few years and so?
Yeah, definitely. A huge shift, I would say. And it does definitely, I'm eternally an optimist. And I kind of think whatever happens, you know, life in some form will continue. You know, things will regrow and things will evolve. So that kind of means for me, I can always hold a sense of wonder to watch all the crazy stuff that's happening in the world, often quite bad stuff, but maintaining that sense of hope. So I always have that, but you do go through kind of dark times when you see that, you know, people and particularly kind of businesses who are directly linked to you know, looking after and have a great opportunity to protect, you know, nature. Don't, you know, they don't see it as being material or they don't see it as being important. So that confuses me, I suppose. I don't see the world through the same eyes as them. So that's what I'm seeing at the moment is actually the lens in which some of those people who are very influential in, you know, whether in government or in business and who for a very long time had like blinkers or a certain lens on their vision, that's kind of shifting. And I think it's the consumer. I think it's children, it's kids, and you know, and their parents who are having to, you know, find ways to get simple pleasures at the moment while they're kind of not able to do all the other things like go to the shopping mall, air conditioned shopping malls. It's like, oh damn! I think that's actually is flowing through because obviously those kids have parents, and those parents are the people that we're talking about. Even if they don't have families. They were kids once, and so they're all of a sudden kind of reawakening to what you were saying at the beginning, Thelia, around those, you know, that connection that we all have and that we're born with nature.
Yeah, and I know from kind of speaking to you before this conversation that you have been part of the World Conservation Congress, and how that used to previously be kind of scientists all coming together, and now there's really a seat at the table for business as well. And I know that you're speaking at this year's Congress. So do you mind giving us a bit of an update on that?
Yeah, it's in Marseille. So I'm obviously not in Marseille. I'm in Kiama on the south coast of New South Wales in Australia. The World Conservation Congress this year is being held in Marseille. I was planning to go and I've been really happy to not have to go. It probably would have just involved a long plane ride, unnecessary probably, time in hotels, etc., away from family. So it's been held a combination of in person and virtually this year. I think it's been extremely successful. So I've been joining sessions at all hours of the night, but really happy to do so to kind of hear people who have inspired me and people who I know really well, just kind of getting energy from community. And that community, I think, has been obviously those people, particularly European colleagues who have been able to get across to France for that, have found it to be like they've really missed that because it can be quite a lonely ride being a conservationist, sometimes by choice, like me, getting lost in forests, and sometimes just because you don't see the world the same way that other hungry consumers see the world. And so those communities are really important. And as I said, they're held every 4 years, and it's typically a chance for that community of conservation to come together. And really over the last 10 years, or probably the last three or four congresses, we've seen the role of business really increase from being a few proactive companies to now it's heavily dominated by a real drive by the business community to be part of the solution and to listen to science. And I think I believe it's a really successful event.
Amazing. I can't wait to hear all about it once it's wrapped up and we get access to to those sessions. So I think we're kind of coming to the end of our conversation now. So I want to end the conversation with the same three questions. So that covers off the areas of think, feel, and do, which are the three areas that our charity kind of works across. So in terms of think, what resources are available for people to go and find out more about this topic?
Yeah, I think I think there's a lot of really fantastic resources out there. I think one that I've only just recently become aware of, but I think it's been around for a little while, and it's a really great, it's only quite small, but it's really grown, and it's something called Restore, and that's R-E-S-T-O-R, Restore, and it's restore.eco, and that's the URL if anyone's interested. It's a spatial platform, and it enables people to kind of find where they are, or a place that they have a connection with. It could be a place where they've been on holiday or a place where they've done an amazing trip to, and to kind of really find what's actually happening there. So what, you know, what conservation activities and actions and programs are happening in that place? What are some of the actual species, plants and animals that are known to occur there? Is it recognized as being, you know, globally significant or nationally a really important area, or is it just something that's extra special for you? And the chance for people to also kind of contribute to like what makes it special for them. So it can be quite a personal kind of thing around developing a local community, sharing it with your friends or your family. Remember, we went on that trip here and look at all this information about it. It behaves a little bit like Google Maps, and I believe that Google have now kind of back-ended the platform. So it's just like you enter in a location. But it's just a really amazing now resource of biodiversity information. And it comes to you not just in academic papers or in long lists of Latin species names, but also in pictures and videos and those kind of things. So, yeah, definitely I would encourage all the listeners to check out restore.eco. It's really cool.
That's awesome. Yeah, we'll definitely put it in the show notes, the link's in there, and I will be checking that out immediately to find out what's lovely creatures are living around me. So the next part is feel. So how do you currently feel about the situation we're in?
Yeah, I think it's I have no choice but to be hopeful. As I said, there is a shift happening. I hope that it's fast enough. I hope we haven't left it too late. I have children, and so I have a responsibility to kind of maintain that hope for them, and to kind of give them the same opportunities and experiences to connect with nature. And so yeah, I have to hope that all of those opportunities are there. So yeah, just I'd say hopeful.
That's a nice note to nearly end on. And then the final one is do. So what would you recommend people do to increase their connection to nature if they've possibly lost it a little bit?
Probably for me, coming back to your first comment, Celia, around like what we lost as that we had when we were children, and the time that we spent, you know, connecting with nature in really simple ways. Whether it was like a tiger moth that kind of, you know, or a ladybird that kind of settled on our knee and we kind of followed it through the park. Most of those activities were done when we weren't wearing shoes. And I have a feeling that we lost a lot of that connection where we decided, or we were told, put your shoes on. You know, don't be silly. Don't walk around with bare foot. It's dirty. It's dangerous. So what people can probably do is take their shoes off. Spend time actually walking on a patch of bindis and feeling that again, kind of like a walk barefoot to work day, or something like that. I think that's a really important thing to be able to connect with nature, is to be able to feel it. And I think how you connect with the ground and the earth is probably the best place to start. So take your shoes off.
I love that. Yeah, real tangible advice. So everyone listening, take your shoes off, go and stand in your local park, or if you're near the beach, feel it in your toes and then feel it in the connection to nature. So that's the end of the conversation, Guy. Thank you so much for speaking to us today.
Oh, absolute pleasure. Yeah, really, really happy to have these chats and look forward to the next one.
Thank you, everyone who's listened as well, for listening into this conversation, and go outside and connect with nature. Thank you.
For more great conversations, please click that subscribe button. And while you're there, if you can rate and review the podcast, we'd be really grateful. It goes a really long way to help spread the word. To keep up to date on everything that's going on with The Beats, the charity that sits behind this podcast, then head on over to our website at thebeats.org, or follow us on Instagram at thebeats_org. Now for the credits. This podcast was produced and edited by me, Celia Kavanagh. Our amazing podcast cover art and music was created by Vinod Rao. Full credit and license information for the original sounds used can be found on our website. And that's it, you've made it to the end. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time.